difference engine of a disciplinary practice that's located in its predicates rather than its subject. I'd like to introduce now Darren Anstead, who is chair or head of the painting curriculum at Curtin University. Thank you.
Thanks, Ted, and everyone. I'm just going to jump straight in without any icebreakers or gags because I think it's a bit long, so hopefully it'll I'll finish it. Okay. This paper, Paintable, All Too Paintable. And I've given it the subtitle, On the Image That Resists the Shift of Medium in the Artwork of Gerhard Richter. So I guess I'm focusing on the image part of transdisciplinary imaging and maybe suggesting there are images that can't make that shift, or maybe this is one of them. So Gerhard Richter's reworking of... And the first thing I'll do is just give you an overview of Gerhard Richter's practice, which is, as you're well aware, I'm sure, extremely varied and diverse, although it more or less always comes back to painting. I'll move on then to specifically his images relating to the subject of National Socialism and briefly mention other artists working in a similar context in a similar time, Marcus Lupertz, Ulrich Beer, and then I'll pull it right back and mention Rodin, or Rodin. So first is a little overview from Richter's very early mural paintings in Dresden to his early pop art. So already you can see an enormous variation in the way he's constructing images. Through to dabblings in conceptual art and photorealism. I guess you wouldn't really call that a dabbling, would you? You know, kitsch. Took the production of mirrors and glass sheets. So part of the way I've tried to understand Richter is by taking a very broad view where the dominant approach seems to be just take one artwork or one series or one style that he's used and to try to unpack that. I actually instead suggest it's better to try and look at everything and fail than it is to succeed at taking one atom from the form. So I'm going to try and do that today. I'm going to try and link everything he's done together with some kind of glue and probably fail, but it should hopefully reveal something about his practice. So this brings us to the images I'm discussing today. He even painted a harpsichord, which is an interesting little genre within painting. Okay, so Gerhard Richter's reworking of modernism's discourse of otherness, and particularly his deconstruction of avant-gardism based in a Hegelian dialectic of binary difference, of subverting the dominant mode through a post-structuralist methodology of ruptures, occlusions, loops, ambiguity and contradiction within and around the image, yet buttressed by an eternal return to a painterly problematization of identity, connotes the discussions of ethical relations of Immanuel Levinas and Jacques Derrida, and for that matter also Hannah Arendt and Theodore Adorno. Their separate but related examinations of ethics largely highlight the radical rethinking required for a prima facie ethical relationship with another person, at least within post-1960s epistemological, political, linguistic and aesthetic systems. Richter's artwork engages these questions in this latter realm. Richter's transposition of modernism into a grammar rather than a steadfast, subversive ideological positioning, which is punctuated with motifs of absent presences from the mirror to the reversed portrait and erased or omitted subject, withdraws from the authorial mode where formerly the modernist artist's speaking voice gave the viewer a perspective. This way of working empties the modernist icons of their iconographic power. Their simultaneity alone of various modernist strategies does this, and ultimately this conceals Richter's own subjectivity. It is a perspective oriented toward difference itself more than toward different things. It is a sensibility oriented toward that which cannot be represented rather than that which can be easily painted. I argue that this sense of the inadequacy of an image, if we turn the equation around, is critically always bound up with an ethical investigation, and an investigation that seeks to go beyond a relative position toward a position where the unrepresentable image takes priority over that for which we already have a sign or indeed an entire semiotic system. Richter's Irv exhibits an ethical limit to representation, and this aligns particularly well with the notion of how one is to relate to another person if one is to take the ethical position according to Levinas and Derrida. Richter's artwork is couched in similar questions in terms of the image as Levinas's assertion that ontology fails to faithfully acknowledge the other person beyond a manifestation of consciousness. Richter's use of neo-Dada strategies of erasure and obscuring the subject of an image in his art practice, as in Uncle Rudy or Aunt Marianne, and which I'll explain below culminate in occlusion. Similarly, Levinas' Levinas attempts to form a theory of the other in its own right, and a humanist philosophy of the other, characterized by a similar deferral. His book Totality and Infinity from 1961, published in the same year that Richter moved from East Germany to West Germany, insists that the other is transcendental and absolute, existing without and beyond the subject, and that only this realization could address the perspectivalism inherent in all prior Western European ontology. He believes that ontology failed to acknowledge the absolute alterity of the other, and that this exempts an ethical relationship with the other person prima facie. I argue that Richter's decisions about what and how to paint exhibit a similar core value. According to Levinas, the other person cannot be entirely known and understood by the subject and is inaccessible to epistemology. He argues for the importance of the question over how to have an ethical exchange with the other rather than the question of explaining the phenomenon of others. Maurice Blanchot worked with Levinas and describes this approach in The Unknowable Community of 1983. And he writes, "An ethics is possible only when, with the ontology which always reduces the other to the same taking the back seat, an anterior relation can affirm itself, a relation such that the self is not content with recognizing the other, with recognizing itself in it, but feels that the other always puts it into question to the point of it being able to respond to it only through responsibility that cannot limit itself and that exceeds itself without exhausting itself." Accordingly, Levinas locates the subject in relation to the other person or being. Because the presence of the other, he argues, is transcendental, it opens up the possibility for ethics by constantly placing the being of the subject into question. The other can arouse a shameful response in the subject, about which Jean-Paul Sartre wrote, but the other can also prompt a response of responsibility for the other, a response that Levinas believes turns the human animal into a human being. Levinas emphasizes this point by substituting the other for God, in a similar manner to René Descartes, who introduced a concept of God also at a late stage in his discussion of mind. Levinas does this to shift the tone of the phenomenology of otherness, in order to break it free from ethical relativism and to make it more concerned with ethical absolutism. For Levinas, the other, even in the simplest form of the first encounter of the infant with the nursing mother, gives the human being self-consciousness and not vice versa. The other represents an alterity that's absolute and thus comes even before language, let alone before the ontology of the subject. Jolanta Novak relates the art of Gerhard Richter to the thought of Levinas in her doctoral thesis, Critical Ethics, Contemporary Art and Art Criticism in Light of Levinas' Aesthetics. In general, Levinas, like Plato, believed that representation cannot responsibly stand in for the other. Novak argues that Richter attempts to make images that can responsibly stand in for the other, particularly in his sensitive depictions of his wife breastfeeding their child. I extend her discussion below to Richter's decisions not to paint, in particular, not to paint the image of anonymous Holocaust victims, but also his decisions to entirely destroy his painting of Hitler and to iconoclastically distort images both related to National Socialism and also more generally. I also extend the discussion to take into account Richter's staging of modernism as a flattened grammar pierced by phenomenal ruptures in terms of Derrida's post-structuralism, which entails the radical positing of otherness as a crisis of ethics emerging in the structure of language. Levinas does not entirely dismiss art. He emphasises responsibility in art, writing, "If art is to go beyond itself, it is to engage with reality. And if that means that it must expose itself to critical exegesis, this does not mean that it must give way to the promotion of a cause or the defence of a social or political thesis. If it means that the artist must interpret his myths to himself, it also means that the artist must be in a position to explain them to others. One person's signifying of him or herself to another, this assignation in unique responsibility for another, is something that can be told by the nakedness of an arm in a sculpture by Rodin," which I take literally. This view of art emphasises the capacity of its reflexive relationship with the viewer. The particular example casts the arm of a figure by Rodin, and particularly its nakedness, as assignation in unique responsibility. Here, Levinas is not fetishizing the arm, and I'm not arguing that he is promoting that Rodin was a good or ethical man. He's discussing taking responsibility for developing a capacity to be in as reflexive a relationship with the viewer as possible. It is this responsibility that I argue is lost in the art of many subsequent avant-garde strategies that are often more concerned with the reflexivity of the subconscious and subversion of the artist's prior or contemporaneous avant-garde come establishment generation. The assignation in unique responsibility by Rodin's sculpture comes from its slippage between the avant-garde positions of Romanticism, Symbolism, and Expressionism. Only by being a constant provocateur of these movements was Rodin able to cast the figure as excess, as psyche, and as rooted in the expression of the artist, too much for avant-gardism, but yet indicative of a responsibility to something greater than a mere subversion. Rodin was able to demonstrate the insufficiency of these styles as a singular orthodoxy by attempting to discharge responsibility to that which is extrinsic to the dominant art styles of the day. He was able to surpass these styles by creating a fusion of them. I argue that Gerhard Richter similarly strives for responsibility to that which is beyond the formal stylistic constructs of the visual at the other end of modernism. His oeuvre attempts to relate visibility to otherness by testing methodological processes as often for other artists, often bound up with an exclusive modernist project with other prior artists. So chance acts, destruction, occluding and dampening of the subject, linked variously to conceptual art, performance art, minimalism and so on, but produced relatively simultaneously in the oeuvre of Gerhard Richter. Levinas's seemingly simplistic statement about a Rodin sculpture is surprisingly in step with Rosalind Krauss's argument that Rodin was the last to make monumental sculpture, and in whose sculpture of Balzac the true project of modernist sculpture can be seen to commence. She suggests that sculpture increasingly takes on a program of negation after Rodin, and the program that Krauss describes responsibility for, signifying, fundamentally shifts as instead, the exploration of negation prompts cascading styles, which eventually culminate in the ultimate negation of minimalism. It is Richter's varied strategies that deconstruct the logic of avant-garde dialectical negation and reintroduce the notion of responsibility for the other. Like many artists of his day, of his moment in 20th century art, instead of the artist's subjectivity bracketing the other in order to focus on the phenomenon, chance processes of blurring the subject or doubling the viewer's gaze, or painting expressively but in highly objective industrial processes, bracket self-expression and the artist's subjectivity and allow an imminent alterity, an otherness imminent in the structure of the oeuvre. to be made apparent. So Richter's post-structuralism demonstrates that meaning is created through the interrelationships of images rather than being created through the image's relation to its signified, or indeed through a signified's relationship to another signified. Yet his oeuvre also indicates that there is at least one image which cannot ethically be made, which cannot even be indirectly engaged, a signification which neither takes place nor is negated, but whose Medusan power requires total omission from the symbolic realm. This ambivalence, the notion that there is both infinite possibility, which I argue in Richter's artwork turns out to be staged, an ever-present impossibility, a vanishing point, the lack for which the visual language of the image stands in like a screen, harks back to a more fundamental problem that's reflected in Richter's oeuvre, the quandary opened up by a pluralism of diverse new possibilities and a question of ethical representation in this brave new world. Derrida argues that the other emerges in a crisis of ethics that occurs within the language system itself. Claude Lévi-Strauss argued, following Lacan, who proposed that the unconscious is structured like a language, that society was structured like a language and speaks through social organisation. In his theory, otherness was the necessary opposition for the identification of subjects. Derrida's emphasis on undecidability, the impossibility of deciding between orders of meaning, and difference, language's difference and deference to meaning as it moves from sign to sign in the linguistic chain, complicates this view of otherness. He suggests that the absolute nature of the alterity of the other, the alterity imminent in the available logical structures, is not a structure available to structuralist linguistics except in a phenomenological capacity, and that it is this phenomenological interruption that carries through Richter's oeuvre in various disturbances. Richter is forced to use the phenomenal effects of rupture because uncomplicated representation counters meaningful consideration of alterity as imminent. Derrida argues that there is no transcendental signified, and thus the alterity of the other is only apparent in the breaching of language and the destabilization of hierarchical structuring. Richter's oeuvre searches for this difference, the slippages and fissures evoked by moving between visual codes, the breaches of the linguistic chain, the destructive negation left in a state of becoming aberrant alongside its formative moment. These ruptures phenomenologically destabilize seamless imbrications between codes and signifiers, shattering modernism's discourse of otherness and postmodernism's infinite relationality like a mirror. Richter encounters the quandary of ethical representation of otherness most when painting historical subjects relating to National Socialism and the Holocaust. His seemingly effortless movement between diverse styles and motifs collapses when attempting to paint Holocaust victims, Hitler and Nazi soldiers. The responsible ethical representation of these subjects resists their unproblematic depiction for circulation in an economy of signs. Such subjects pose Adorno's notion that lyrical poetry is impossible after Auschwitz. Richter wanted to paint photographs of concentration camp victims beside pornographic images, but felt this could not be done. Thanks. For my purposes, the project yielded an unpaintable image. However, the original photographic sketches remain in his atlas. In order to understand Richter's intent, it is necessary to momentarily turn to Žižek's discussion of Hannah Arendt's text, Eichmann in Jerusalem, A Report on the Banality of Evil, from 1963. Arendt wrote the text after covering the Adolf Eichmann war crimes trial in Jerusalem for the New Yorker. The trial revealed how easily catastrophic consequences can ensue from the mere following of orders. Žižek agreed with Arendt's rejection of the idea of a sublime evil. He concurs that the notion of the Nazi as a kind of evil genius is misguided. Richter's work also suggests this, as he intersperses banal imagery with images that deal with Nazism. Žižek argues that the evil was generally committed by the average bureaucrat who was following orders, but he goes much further, disagreeing with Arendt on the point that these Nazis were merely following orders. Instead, he points to their enjoyment of following horrific orders as a kind of sexual perversion. He proposes that this pleasure arises from tension between the performative instrumental activity and the secret obscene way it is enjoyed. Richter's project would have underscored this conceptualization of the horrors of Nazism in that it was underpinned by the same drives that are invested in pornography. The fact that he did not paint these images from death camps, but that the plans remain in Atlas beside pornographic images, strikes a position between the perverse banal evil suggested by Žižek and the unrepresentable image along the lines of Adorno's imperative. It suggests that the structure of civilization creates the fetishized dehumanization of the other, which ought to lie, in fact, at the unpaintable vanishing point of symbolic representation. Holocaust photography has a different status to Holocaust painting. Holocaust photography is the subject of a large discourse with many facets. Most eminently, the photograph's role of historical documentation distinguishes it from the painted image. On this point, the work of different documentary photographers who were in Germany immediately after the war has been seen as more or less sensitive to the suffering of victims. The photographic images in Richter's Atlas span both ends of this spectrum. Some images are more sensitive, showing only two or three starved and tortured figures, their faces staring at the viewer. Others seem more anaesthetic, images of masses of dead bodies, more distant from the viewer, and with whom a direct relationship with the viewer is less emphasised, but these are perhaps better able to indicate the colossal Richter to take a position on this spectrum, perhaps a decision that was unbearable to make. The painting of images of anonymous Holocaust victims generates a different discourse, yet one more perplexed by a question of responsibility. Richter's artwork suggests that responsible representation of the already dehumanised other is, after all, impossible. His withdrawal from painting the images effectively says that the other human being is transcendental and absolute, along the lines of the theory of Levinas. However, like a carefully framed silence, this position comes only after working through the sketches wherein he applied ink to the source photographs to explore ways of engaging the subject. Here, an unpaintable space between the codes and signifiers of representation is an otherness immanent within language, manifest as a crisis of ethics within language. Leaving the photographic images in Atlas, the shadow catalogue of his oeuvre, makes the absence of the painting the ghostly hole to which all other ruptures in the oeuvre point. Richter completed a painting of his aunt Marianne as a young girl, who was murdered under the Nazi Party decree to euthanise the infirm in Aunt Marianne from 1965. Richter's intellectually disabled aunt was not an anonymous statistic and thus does not pose the same problem of ethical representation that Richter experienced with painting other unknown victims. She was part of his family and what Levinas would call a same rather than an other. By painting her beside himself as an infant together on a blanket, this closeness is emphasised. Painting encounters difficult subjects when connotative qualities of the image are easily confused with denotative qualities. Marcus Lupus used motifs such as Wehrmacht helmets and officers' caps in his artwork from 1970 to 1974. Siegfried Goer noted that Lupus entered the path towards a redefinition of his painting by facing up to the greatest emotional barrier, the taboo of silence imposed on the Nazi period, and breaking through it with his German motifs. However, the artwork caused a furor because the use of such symbols was seen as too similar to their use by the Nazis. The painting Hitler from 1963, which Richter destroyed shortly after having made, undoubtedly caused a similar tension. It is a clear, flat, stenciled image of Adolf Hitler in a pop art style. The figure is shouting over the left shoulder of the viewer in an imposing pose. Jürgen Hartmann has pointed out that the image references the Berlin group who were working expressionistically in the mid-1960s in Berlin. Its leader, Ulrich Baer, started the first contemporary artist-run space in Germany, the Galerie Gross Gerschen, 35. His paintings rejected the neutrality of history painting and sought to be critical and political rather than objective. However, Richter's treatment of Hitler represents him as also what Levinas would call a same. He is not completely demonised nor alienated in the painting, which problematises reading him as the profoundly evil mass murderer of the 20th century. While his image is dampened by being flattened out and made banal and placed on a deadpan gestural grey background, the usual sense of inconsequence associated with pop, as in Warhol's colourful Mao paintings, is nonetheless absent. In Richter's earlier oeuvre, the image has a place alongside images of toilet paper, antler horns, and a portrait of Lassie. However, the iconographic power of Hitler casts a shadow over the other banal subjects, remaining even after the destruction of the painting. It is too strong for the dampening effects of pop representation. It is the shadow of the banal paintings, and it imbues them with a gravitas they would not otherwise have. While the disjunctive string of images foregrounds the banality of evil about which Hannah Arendt wrote in that same year, and the dampening has been attempted, the image was too inextinguishable, too powerful to be allowed to remain in existence. It is paintable, all too paintable. It represented Hitler too clearly as the same, which this time called for the radical erasure of the image and upholding of a taboo punctuating Richter's movement through codes and signifiers, made and unmade, although this time unmade completely. All in all, this argument demonstrates the critical necessity of taking a broad view of Richter's oeuvre. It is an oeuvre with a courageous and sustained objective. An expansive view of the oeuvre, of course, cannot take the entirety of it into account, but it can give an indication as to some of the objectives, achievements, and shortcomings.